Good afternoon and welcome to the August meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Erickson Hall in Northport on the coast of Maine. A particular welcome to our public radio audience coming to you through the facilities of the Maine Public Broadcast Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, standing in for Mac DeFord, president of the forum. We were founded in 1983, so the forum is now in its 30th year, celebrating in December its 30th anniversary. That's 30 years of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomatic policy, and often the lack thereof. Details about past and upcoming programs available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The forum is delighted to be able to bring you today Fred Kaplan, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and an author of a dozen or more books. Some of the books, I want to read you some of the titles, because just to give you some idea of the diversity of the man's areas of interest. His most recent book is called The Insurgents, about David Petraeus and his attempt to change the nature of counterinsurgency. And that's going to be the subject of Fred's talk, I think, today. Isn't that, Fred? whatever, right. But there are a host of other books. Daydream Believers, about the George W. Bush foreign policy at the beginning of this century, or the foreign policy, or lack thereof. Oliver Twist, the critical edition. Oh, no, that's a different Fred Kaplan? That's a different Fred Kaplan. Okay, I'm sorry. 1959, the year that changed everything, is the story of the simultaneous change of popular culture, the nuclear strategic element, and some Supreme Court changes that ushered in a new era, a sea change in the affairs of man. I think Fred's going to be talking about counterinsurgency. So, Fred Kaplan, welcome.
So I'd like to say that there are four writers named Fred Kaplan, and I'm three of them. But the other one is this guy who writes biographies of literary figures, Mark Twain, Gore Vidal, and so forth. That's someone else, and I think he lives in Maine, actually. Maybe that's part of the confusion. Maybe you thought you were inviting him up to this thing instead of me. But anyway, I want to thank everybody for being here. I've heard about this organization for many years, but wondered whether it really existed. So it's good to be here. And I want to thank Tom and Sally for their hospitality, and my old quasi-mentor at the Boston Globe, David Greenway, for suggesting that I be invited to speak here. I guess the thing that I'll focus on, since that's what I was told what I should do, is, you know, whatever happened to counterinsurgency? You might recall not that long ago, 10 years ago, we were told that there was a long war going on, that Iraq and Afghanistan were the models for the wars of the future. We are going to be facing, you know, endless streams of these kinds of wars. And that luckily we had this guy named David Petraeus who had figured out a way to fight them through this magical strategy called counterinsurgency, which supposedly worked wonders in Iraq and was also going to prove miraculous in Afghanistan. So jump to the present, or even a couple of years ago, I think it's extremely unlikely that we're going to get involved in anything like Iraq and Afghanistan for quite a long time to come, even though we might do some bombing and strafing and drone strikes here and there, in fact, quite a lot of places. And David Petraeus is close to becoming a forgotten figure at this point, besides the scandal that that led to his downfall. He's having a bit of a revival in other worlds, but there isn't much sign that too many people seem to care. So the question is, what happened? How did this mirage of international politics come about, and how did it fall? Well, the book, which I am sorry for many reasons that there aren't copies here. I was hoping to review it for its first moment anyway, but I'll see if I can remember. It begins, in fact, at the Gulf War of 1991. And it starts with this guy named John Nagle, who's about 25 years old, graduated near the top of his class at West Point. When you graduate from West Point, you're asked, what branch of the Army would you like to go into? And they choose from the top down. And all the guys at the top said, well, I want to go into armor. Because the big war of the future was going to be NATO-Warsaw Pact. It was going to be led by tanks. And so if you're an armor officer, that was where the real action was. And in fact, Nagle became fluent in German because he figured that he would be spending the bulk of his career in Germany. So he's there in Iraq, and he's the company leader of a tank company. And all of a sudden, you know, after a month of bombing, the ground war is over in, you might recall, in 100 hours. The Iraqi army, you know, the fourth largest tank army in the world, is just slaughtered, just obliterated. A few months earlier, the Cold War is over. The Soviet Union no longer exists. And so after the Iraq War, it becomes clear that nobody is going to challenge the United States military to a head-on clash of strength. And so Nagle is wondering, well, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And where is the army going? What is even the point of the army? And slowly he begins to realize, well, there might be these other kinds of conflicts that we might have to face. And, you know, there were civil wars going on in Central America. There were crises in Somalia. And so he went to Oxford for graduate school, and he wrote a dissertation on comparing how the Brits basically won in Malaya and how the Americans lost in Vietnam, and why the one did okay and the other didn't. And he was studying books and archives that nobody had looked at ever, or perhaps in decades. There was dust, literally dust, on the papers that he was going through. And he came up, he figured out that his conclusion was that the Malayan military was built for counterinsurgency, and the American army was not. The American army was basically trying to refight World War II and the Korean War in Vietnam, and it was the wrong kind of war. So he wrote a book called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, which came from Lawrence of Arabia, who said fighting insurgencies is slow and messy like eating soup with a knife. So it turned out they probably should have paid more attention to the slow and messy part than the fancy eating soup with a knife thing. But so, at the same time, other people are coming up looking at these same kinds of ideas. And this is where we get to Petraeus, who later became a mentor of Nagle at West Point and elsewhere. Petraeus had graduated from West Point in 1974. He's sent off to France to be a paratrooper. And while there, he kind of gets involved in reading about counterinsurgency. There was a big tradition of counterinsurgency in France. And he's reading... There was a book by a guy named Galula called Counterinsurgency Warfare and Theory and Warfare, or something like that. Counterinsurgency Warfare, Theory and Practice. So he's reading things like, it's not always important to kill the enemy. You must protect the people you're trying to protect. Sometimes a mimeograph machine can be more useful than a machine gun. Sometimes cement can be more important than mortar. And he gets this whole idea about what we now call nation building that he'd never been taught about at West Point, never been taught about in the Command and General Staff College. And he says, well, this is actually the way that things are going to go. By the mid-80s, he's down in Central America. And that's when the civil wars are really going on very strong. And he sees what's going on in El Salvador, in Honduras. And he's seeing that certain elements of special forces are putting in motion a kind of a counterinsurgency strategy. He goes to Haiti a little bit later and is involved in leading a kind of an intelligence unit that's doing essentially counterinsurgency. Later he goes to Bosnia. I'm obviously condensing things quite a lot here. I'm periscoping this quite a bit. So he goes to Bosnia, and what's going on there is a major counterterrorism or a clandestine counterterrorism campaign, as well as the fight against Milosevic. And he's involved in this, and he sees that a lot of it involves not just going after the terrorists, but also, beefing up the justice system, providing social services, this sort of thing. So, the Iraq War begins. As I say, I'm really compressing quite a lot here, but we have to get through this. The Iraq War begins, and as you recall, the rather astonishing thing about the Iraq War is that nobody had thought of what to do after Saddam Hussein fell. You know, some of you in the military who come from military circles know that, you know, there are four phases in battle, and the phase four is after the battle, is after the combat phase. The Pentagon had not worked up any phase four plan. I mean, there was a bad phase four plan. There was no phase four plan. And part of this was deliberate. Rumsfeld basically just wanted to topple Saddam Hussein with these wonder weapons that he'd helped propagate. And the army, you know, the army after the Vietnam War, the army wanted no part of this stuff ever again. They had a field manual on counterinsurgency. They literally threw it away. And they said, we're not doing this anymore. We're going back. And the Warsaw Pact was kind of rising at the time, too. So, oh, great. We're going to go back to focusing on what we know how to do, which are big wars fought against big foes. And Vietnam was sort of forgotten about. And anything related to guerrillas or insurgents or anything like it was forgotten about. So Petraeus was commander of the 101st Airborne Division. And he's assigned to go up to Mosul in northern Iraq. And not only was there no idea of what to do, but there was no centralized command. Petraeus was kind of up on his own. And so without telling anybody, without asking for permission, he starts putting forth a counterinsurgency strategy. He opens up the university. He opens up some newspapers. He opens up, at his own initiative, the border with Syria so that goods can come across. He vets candidates for an election, a city council election. It happens. He's taking the discretionary commander's fund and basically paying people to clean up the streets and do that sort of thing. And for the 9 months that he's there, things are actually pretty good in northern Iraq. And then there's this enormous turnover. All the troops leave, new troops come in. The new ones had no idea what he was doing. We're not interested in looking at any of the megabytes of records that had been kept. And so they just go off doing what most of the commanders there were doing, namely pounding down doors, shooting and arresting people who might be insurgents. Oh, because, you know, an insurgency war. After the war was over, insurgents start coming up. Most generals and colonels, all that they knew was just to go shooting and killing and arresting anybody who might look like an insurgent. So that resumes and all goes to hell. So Petraeus goes back to the United States. And a lot of generals don't like David Petraeus because he was too bookish and he talked to the press too much. And most army generals in those days, they didn't like bookishness and they didn't like generals who stood out. And he did both of those things. So they send him to Leavenworth, Kansas. And they figure, you know, they figure they're sending him away, you know, literally sending the fair boy out to pasture. But he gets out there and he discovers, wait a minute, Leavenworth is really where everything is happening. The Command General Staff College is here. They write doctrine here. There's this command post where the people come train before they get out. And he reorients the whole thing to become like counterinsurgency. Now, something else is going on in the meantime. There are a lot of meanwhiles in this book. Meanwhile, there's a guy named Elliot Cohen who teaches at SAIS in Washington, D.C. And Elliot is he's a very prominent military scholar, and he was one of the leading neocon figures. He was one of the people signing petitions, even during the Clinton administration, that we should go overthrow Saddam Hussein by force. And he's also a member of the Defense Advisory Board. And he went over to Iraq, unlike anybody else on the board. And he's saying that it's a disaster, that this thing is falling apart, that there's an insurgency war going on, and Donald Rumsfeld and everybody below is, even if they refuse even to recognize that there are insurgents. You might remember that Rumsfeld just prohibited all of his people from even mentioning the word insurgency. And he knew, this by the way was deliberate, he knew that if there was an insurgency, you might have to have a counterinsurgency strategy, and that means we're stuck there for years, and he didn't want to do that. So Elliot Cohen goes over there and realizes this is terrible. So every summer, Elliot sponsors this thing at in Vermont, a week-long seminar for academics in this national security field in Basin Harbor, Vermont, to get along, you know, talk about new ways to teach national security. He realizes this summer we've got to do something different. We've got to talk about better ways to fight the Iraq War. And so he goes through his Rolodex and he goes through his magazines and he just invites everybody who's written anything interesting about counterinsurgency, which isn't that many people. Noggle is one of them. There are several others. It's about 30 people. And they get together and they talk about these things and they have very interesting talks. But what's really important about this are the dinners and the walks around the lake and these people, most of whom were struggling at coming up with counterinsurgency and trying to revive counterinsurgency on their own, realizing that these other people exist. Most of them didn't know of each other's existence. And they realize, well, we have a community here. We have a community of like-minded scholars. Most of them are junior officers or think tank types, a few people in the State Department, Pentagon. And so Petraeus knows some of these people too. And so when Petraeus gets to the point of trying to rewrite a counterinsurgency manual, he doesn't do it through the normal doctrine writing department at Fort Leavenworth. He draws on his entourage mainly from these people who were out at Basin Harbor. And so there's this new community. And that's the group of people who basically revive counterinsurgency theory. This had another origin too. When John Noggle went back to West Point after the first Iraq War to teach in the 90s, he and a lot of other professors in the political science department, they had similar experiences. Well, Noggle had fought in what the Army would call a real war, you know, tank on tank. These other guys had fought in Somalia or Bosnia or El Salvador. And at the time, the Army's official definition of war was major combat operations, you know, tank on tank, big power against big power. The name for all other kinds of conflicts was military operations other than war. It was not war, it was other than war. So this was MOOTW, which was, to add further insult, it was pronounced mutwa. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time was once overheard saying, real men don't do mutwa. So these young officers are coming up and they see this is disastrous because we're not really facing the right kinds of war. So anyway, to continue making a long story a little bit less long, Petraeus goes back to Iraq as commander. And it's a very interesting story for which you'll have to buy the book about how this happened, because it too is kind of a conspiracy. The subtitle of this book is David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. It really was a plot, every single aspect of it. He goes back to Iraq, and he essentially institutes this counterinsurgency strategy. I mean, while this was going on, the you might remember the Sons of Iraq were coming along, the Sunni insurgents who were realizing that Al-Qaeda was not the best ally, and Petraeus basically paid them to come join us. I mean, there was a much bigger commander's discretionary fund, and again, this was mainly for commanders to use, you know, to pay people to sweep the streets, to, you know, that kind of thing. Petraeus used this money, again, without telling anybody in Washington, to pay salaries to Sunni militias for coming over to our side. I mean, really, I mean, if this had been known by people in Washington, I mean, these were people who had been shooting at American soldiers weeks earlier and might, a few weeks hence, be shooting at American soldiers again. So that was part of it. And then the other part, he had to also go after Shia militias. And under General Casey, his predecessor, Casey wanted to go into Sadr City and go after those militias too. Sadr had an alliance with Prime Minister Maliki. Malachi told Casey, stay out of Sadr City. And so he said, okay, well, it's your country. Petraeus just did it. He just went into Sadr City. And Petraeus' whole style of leadership was just to do what he thought should be done and not pay any attention to anybody else. So what happens in 2007 is that a combination of the surge and the switch to a counterinsurgency strategy really did have a dramatic effect. And here, when I was researching the book, I actually had a change of mind in this. I thought it was all a coincidence, but it really wasn't. It really did have an effect. But still, it was a tactical effect. It was just a short-term effect. Petraeus had said many times the whole point of the surge was to give the Iraqi factions some breathing space so they can work out their disagreements in peace without worrying about bombs going off every 5 minutes. So he gave them the breathing space. But the fallacy was that Maliki really wasn't interested in working out the disagreements with the Shia. He wasn't interested in sharing oil revenue. He wasn't interested in co-opting much of the Sunni militias into the National Army. He wasn't interested in settling the matters with the Kurds. And so that's why now we see, although at a much lower level, we see a return to sectarian warfare, a return to car bombings, a return to, you know, to casualties. It's because the Iraqis weren't interested in what Petraeus was up to. He was providing the means, but they weren't interested in the ends. So now we go to Afghanistan. Okay, Petraeus is put in charge of Afghanistan. Petraeus, by this time, things still look pretty good in Iraq, so he's viewed as a miracle worker, you know, the miracle worker of Iraq. Will he be able to work miracles in Afghanistan as well? And so he takes out these books on counterinsurgency that he's been reading for many years and that have been the basis for a lot of what he's doing, and he tries to do it in Afghanistan. But here's the problem. You know, when he was commander of Iraq, that was his third tour in Iraq. He really knew the place. He'd never been to Afghanistan. He brings with him the same entourage that had been with him in Iraq. They'd never been in Afghanistan either. They don't know anything about Afghanistan. Not only that, but Obama, Obama, after these 10 meetings of the National Security Council, decides to give this a chance. But he sees it as an experiment. He gives Petraeus 18 months to get anything done. Okay, you have 18 months. He says, can you, in the last meeting before Obama agrees to this policy, he says to Petraeus and the other military people, can you tell me that within 18 months, you can make enough progress, you can turn things around to the point where the Afghan army is in the lead in most of the provinces? Now, Petraeus knew that this was impossible. It was way too little time. But he and everybody else says, yes, sir, yes, sir. Because they figured that, like most presidents, you know, you make enough progress, and your time is out, but you've made enough progress and you say, Mr. President, I think, you know, two more brigades and we are settled. Two more brigades. Most presidents in the past have said, okay, all right, yeah, let's do it. So that was his gamble. So he gets to Afghanistan, and one of his aides, who I talked to, who had been in Afghanistan for a while, as well as in Iraq, a lot of people told me that everybody, in fact, is noticing that, you know, Petraeus is presented with a problem, and he'll say, you know, when this happened in Baghdad, we did this. Or when this happened in Anbar province, we did that. And at one time in a meeting with President Karzai is talking about a problem. And he goes, well, you know, in Mosul, we did it this way. And they're walking out of the room, and Petraeus' aide says to him, you know, it might be an interesting intellectual experiment to try not to think about Iraq. And Petraeus said, well, I'm working on it. So Petraeus, faced with time pressure, not really knowing what to do, kind of does everything. He steps up counterinsurgency, but he also steps up airstrikes and nighttime raids. He does everything. It's an all-out attack, just trying to get something done. And of course it doesn't work, because he kind of knew that this was a gamble maybe beyond even his capabilities. Because if you look at this book by David Galula, which he read years ago, there is a chapter called Favorable Conditions for an Insurgency. And he lists the things, characteristics of a country which make it really prime territory for an insurgency. And they included things like a very corrupt central government, an illiterate, largely rural population, a border with a country which can give sanctuary to insurgents. I mean, just down the list, if you read them, it's like a portrait of Afghanistan. In fact, he even draws a little diagram of what a country favorable to insurgencies would look like. It's practically a diagram of Afghanistan. This just was never going to work, ever. And so, interestingly, remember when President Obama gave his talk where he said, "We basically fulfilled our mission in Afghanistan, and so I am pulling out the surge troops that I put in." Now, he presented this as a victory, and he could get away with it to some degree because in the meantime, the SEALs had killed Osama bin Laden, and in fact, the Taliban were cut back quite a bit in the field, and Al-Qaeda was almost destroyed. But what really happened was that if you look at the date when Obama asked, "Can you assure me that within 18 months this will happen?" and the date when Obama gave that speech saying, "Okay, we're basically out of there," it was almost exactly 18 months to the date. What was really going on is that Obama knew that it hadn't worked. And Petraeus knew this as well. So what are the lessons? And now what happens? 1 year after that, Obama presents, along with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a new security strategy. The part of this strategy that got the most press was the pivot. Remember the pivot from the Middle East and Europe to Asia? But another part of it gave a directive to the Army and the Marines. It said, "You will not size your forces for protracted, large-scale stability operations," which was basically a way of saying, don't plan on doing counterinsurgency like this anymore. And there were then some paragraphs about, of course, you will retain personnel with expertise in this, you will retain in your educational institutes, but you know, if you're in the military and you've got a shrinking budget anyway, and you've been told you will not size your forces for such and such a mission, then you are being told this is no longer a core mission. This is a mission that you can put at the bottom of the heap if you have other things that you need funded. And so what we have now, we do have a lot of conflicts going on in the world, obviously, and a lot of insurgency movements, just about every region that you look. And yet, nobody is talking about reviving the kind of counterinsurgency strategies. But why not? Here's the thing. In some places they work, in some places they don't. It's not, Petraeus and the others got so enmeshed in this, so devoted to their idea, and it was almost an ideology, that they thought it could be applied everywhere. But in fact, the real problem is twofold. One, these places where you're supposed to go and win the hearts and minds of the people and understand their culture and appeal to their interests and provide basic service, we don't know anything about these places. I mean, the biggest shortage in Iraq wasn't ammunition or tanks or armored vehicles or anything, it was translators. And if you don't even have people who can speak the language, how are you supposed to find out what they really need? It worked for a little while in certain places in Iraq because our interests and the various militias' interests were aligned at that moment. However, our interests and the national government's interests were not aligned at all. Maliki wanted to do completely different things from what the US wanted to do. And in Afghanistan, the alignment of interests were completely off. For a counterinsurgency to work, you have to have reforms in the government to make the government more trustworthy to the people. So the people turn away from the insurgents and ally themselves, you know, do allegiance to the government. And yet the whole basis of Maliki's regime was corruption. It was this criminal predatory network of warlords and just criminals out in the governorships and the districts. And so to insist, to tell to insist that Karzai initiate reforms was to insist that he give up power, and that just wasn't going to happen. And so what Obama is now doing, if there is an Obama style of war, it's actually it's the opposite of counterinsurgency. And maybe Petraeus and these guys were right that you couldn't really change the dynamics on the ground unless you got into the heart of the matter. The fact is, we don't know how to get to the heart of the matter in a lot of these places. And it takes way too long to get there, even if we did. And so, in kind of an ironic way, we're reverting to more of the Rumsfeld style of warfare, which is, you know, smart bombs and special forces, go in very quick, you know, kill terrorists, get out. Obama has elongated this a bit. Obama is very keen on working with allies, which Rumsfeld never was. And he's working on allies, basically for the allies to do the brunt of the work, which people make fun of this and they call it leading from behind, like in Libya. Well, you know, it's actually not a bad idea. I mean, for example, in Libya, there were certain things that U.S. forces could do, you know, fire cruise missiles and other precise munitions at targets, provide intelligence, logistics. But then what Obama did not want to do was to get stuck there. He is allergic to escalation. He is allergic to getting immersed in things that have no end in sight. And so in Libya, the French and the Italians certainly had much more vital interest in Libya than the United States did. So he said, you do it. And I think that what we're going to find in Syria, I wrote a column just the other day, I think he is going to end up bombing certain military targets in Syria. But I think he's going to do it in collaboration with NATO, led by Turkey, and getting the Saudis involved and other Arabs involved. And it's going to be the same thing. It's going to be, we will do what we are uniquely capable of doing, and then the rest is up to you. It's the opposite of counterinsurgency. We're not going to influence the politics on the ground, because there's a realization that we have really very limited knowledge and power to do this. So I think right now we're groping. I'll leave you with one more thought, and then I'll turn it over to questions. It's my view that after we won the Cold War, American power actually went down. It didn't go up, it went down. The real fallacy in the Bush administration was thinking that, it's a unipolar world. We're the only superpower right now. So we can go all around the world and doing all those things and nobody will be able to do anything about it. But what was really going on is that, you know, back in the old days when there was, again, oversimplifying, U.S., Soviet Union, world divided into two, a lot of countries kind of went along with what we wanted them to do. It wasn't really so much in their interest, but they preferred going along with us than the alternative. Well, now the alternative is imploded. They have lots of alternatives. They can go with us, or they can do a lot of other things. For example, you know, the Egyptians. Egypt, you know, they had been an ally of the Soviet Union. When Sadat came over to us, he bought on to a lot of U.S. interests in doing so that he could keep getting weapons from us and aid from us. He needed some kind of superpower patron. Now there is no superpower patron, and we're finding, to our distress, that even though we give the Egyptian military all this money, they'll go along with us when it suits their interests and not go along with it when it doesn't. So the world as it is right now, people say, oh, you know, Obama lost the Middle East, or Obama's lost influence in Egypt. Nobody would have. The United States has lost influence in all these places. It's the nature of the world. It's the nature of this new inchoate international system. So I think what we're really in the middle of is probably several decades of something approaching international anarchy. And it's going to take quite a while for anybody to figure out how to create some new Congress of Vienna to control things. But the real moral of my story is that David Petraeus is not the kind of guy to do it, and counterinsurgency is not the strategy for doing it. So thank you very much. So I'll take questions about anything.
We're going to take questions in writing. So pass your questions to any of the people collecting. I have a couple to start with here. You cited the British in Malaya, the War of the Running Dogs, as an example of successful counterinsurgency. One of the things they did was they put a price on the head of anybody they could name on the other side and paid them off. Is that something that has worked for Petraeus in Iraq,
well,
for instance?
Petraeus did a lot of paying off. There was a lot of paying off. But you've hit on something very important, which a lot of the counterinsurgency advocates, the modern counterinsurgency advocates, ignored. And when I interviewed them, I interviewed well over 100 people for this book. I would frequently ask, I would say, you know, in Malaya, you know, the British just relocated 400,000 people and put them in what were called concentration camps. And the same thing was true of the Americans in the Philippines at the turn of the 20th century, which is also often cited as an exemplary instance of counterinsurgency. The thing is, this is a very brutal technique. It might be, it's seen and presented by these guys as a graduate level warfare. This is a smart, you know, the dumb warfare is just pounding down doors and arresting anybody. This is smarter. But, you know, in the day when it had success such as it was extremely brutal. And in fact, John Nagle, who is still an outspoken advocate of counterinsurgency, once said the ideal environment for a counterinsurgency campaign is on a peninsula against an ethnically distinct minority in an age before CNN. So, you know.
We have a stunning number of people that are asking the same question, which is more or less, how do we deal with asymmetric conflict? What should we do?
Well, I mean, this is the question, because as you recognize, that is really probably the only kind of conflicts that we're going to be involved in or tempted to be involved in. You know, I don't foresee a war with a resurgent Russia. I don't see a war with China, and if there is one, it's not going to be on the ground. So it's all asymmetric. But I mean, the thing about asymmetric, of course, is that we each have different instruments of power. The instruments of power that we built up over the last 60 years were instruments of power designed mainly for these big wars, which is why, you know, in Vietnam and again in Iraq, you know, the thing in Vietnam, how can this little pissant country, Vietnam, beat the United States of America? And there was this idea, you know, if you can lick the cat, you can lick the kitty, you know, that whole thing. And it turned out that licking the kitty was another proposition entirely. I think, you know, much as Obama's pronouncements on foreign policy and policies on various conflicts might be unsatisfying and even a little frustrating, I think he has the key insight here. And if you go back, okay, it was kind of ridiculous that he won the Nobel Prize, but go back and read the address that he gave. It was maybe one of the most intelligent speeches on the nature of power in the modern age that any president has ever given. I really think so. But one thing that he recognizes, and he can only say this to some extent, politically you can't say this too explicitly, he said that he recognizes the limits of American power, that you cannot just go blow up a lot of stuff and that things are going to change on the ground. I think he even understands this idea that when you don't have the fulcrum of another superpower to threaten, you know, to operate in the shadow of, your options in fact become more, not less limited. I think he also, you know, he was born in 1961, so the Vietnam War is not part of his, you know, it's not built into him as Vietnam is to someone, say, of my age or your age. But he's talked with a lot of people who have studied the Vietnam War. He is very conscious. He is very worried about escalation. And he also understands that we're not the world's policemen. We don't have the money to be. We don't have the desire to be. And so that's why when he does decide to get involved in military missions, he does so only in an alliance. And more often than not these days, with the country that has the most interest in the outcome and aftermath of this conflict taking the lead. He doesn't want to get in a situation where we kick out the dictator and then we're stuck there for 10 years footing all the bills and losing even more people. He's saying, look, you want to get involved in that part? We're with you, but it's your business. It's not primarily ours.
Well, think about this example that you cited of a country where insurgency is a natural, that it has the profile of Afghanistan, where there's a criminal, this is your words, criminal predatory network in control, where it's going to take way too long to do anything. Should we just walk away from those? Is that?
Well, I think, as I say, my guess is that Obama regrets stepping into it more deeply than was already there. And it took him, you know, several NSC meetings to get there. I think, in fact, you know, people laugh at Joe Biden, but Biden is actually a very important person in the Obama administration, and he calls on Biden a lot, if just for devil's advocate, because in those conversations, Biden was the one person saying, you know, this counterinsurgency thing is a lot of crap. We should just do what was called counterterrorism plus, which was, okay, yeah, go after the insurgents on the border, do the safe house raids if you know who exactly is there, try to shape up the government a bit, and then accelerate the training of the Afghan military so that they can take over this fight in the end. And that is something that Petraeus and his successors have done. The Afghan army is in a lot better shape than it was. But yeah, I think we are getting out of there. I think when people say, oh, well, you know, no, we should keep, you know, 10,000, 30,000, however many troops there, I don't see it happening. I think we're by 2014, 2015, we are out. I think that's really the case.
I have two questions here about budgeting. Given your description of the U.S. strategic context, should we welcome wise reductions in military budgets, especially in nuclear forces? What does what you have said say about the size of the Pentagon budget?
Well, it's a different issue, but I've looked at that for a while. I think the defense budget could be pretty dramatically cut without any impact on our security. For example, we are still spending something like $20 billion a year on the upkeep and, in some cases, modernization of the strategic nuclear force. This is just crazy. I mean, I can't, you know, there is a targeting agency at the Strategic Command, which, you know, okay, this weapon, we're gonna target this weapon will go against that. This is very elaborate, very detailed. They keep it up to date all the time. You know, I would be very surprised to see anything that looks reasonable, any campaign, no matter against who, that has more than 600 or 700 targets. And I don't know why you need more than 1,000 nuclear weapons, and I think that's probably even pushing it. But, you know, this is what happens with politics. I mean, Obama wanted to sign the START treaty, was it START? What did they call it? The New START treaty with the Russians, which I think was a very good thing. But to get the two-thirds majority from the Senate, he had to agree to increase the budget for various nuclear. This, by the way, is a perpetual theme in arms control. Throughout, from the beginning, in order to get the Senate to sign an arms control treaty, presidents have had to agree to build up to the maximum allowed by the treaty, to raise the budget. In fact, one of my old professors at MIT, George Rathjens, made the case even back in the early 70s that maybe we would be better off just figuring out how many we need and just to do that and to forget about nuclear arms treaties. I mean, he was being a little exaggerating, but there's something to it. The Army, you know, the Army is being cut quite drastically because what is their mission, really? I mean, if you're not going to have major combat operations and if you're not going to have large-scale counterinsurgency, and if the small stuff is being handled mainly by special forces, what is the conventional army doing? I mean, this is a true existential crisis going on in the Army now. The Navy, you know, you could, you don't have to read anything later than Alfred Mahan and you could come up with a rationale for what the Navy is doing. Just, you know, control of the sea lanes, counter China. They're kind of flush. The Air Force, they're in a crisis of, you know, how much manned aircraft, how much unmanned aircraft. But the big thing is personnel. That's where a lot of the budget is going. And I think you will find in the next few years drastic cuts in the size of the military. I think that'll continue happening.
Our speaker 2 months ago, I think, was Gregory Johnson speaking about Yemen. And he addressed himself to a great degree about the use of drones in Yemen. Wouldn't drones constitute at least something which was explicitly focused on countering insurgency? And if so, what's your take on them? Is this going to be a successful tactic for dealing with such problems?
Yeah. Well, drones are this sort of... I won't use that phrase. Drones are... they're a little too easy. I mean, the wonderful thing about drones is that you see an enemy or a safe house or something over here, and you can't get to it, and you don't really want to get to it. You don't want to do the things that can get you there. And you can just, you know, blow it up from afar, and you have somebody, you're not going to even lose a pilot. The guy is sitting in a trailer halfway around the world looking at a monitor and manning a joystick. It's easy. Now, one thing, there have been some cases where, you know, certain very high-level targets, as they call it, yeah, we want this guy out of the way. There he is, let's do it. And it's done. And the weapons that the drones drop are really remarkably accurate. I mean, you know, we're talking 3 to 10 feet from, it would land 3 to 10 feet from the target. And it's a small bomb, too. So, for example, somebody could fire a drone at me, and, you know, I don't know, the person sitting way over there might get a few cuts, but really nothing much more than that. So it's pretty remarkable in a technological sense. It's what Robert Oppenheimer said of the hydrogen bomb, that it's technically sweet. It's a technically sweet solution. But here's the problem, and people like Petraeus understood this. You know, remember all the times when a newscast would say they've killed the number 3 al-Qaeda leader in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and then a month later, they've killed another number 3 leader of Afghanistan. Then another, there is a never-ending supply of number 3 leaders of al-Qaeda. You're not doing anything to deal with the problem. And in fact, there are cases of Yemen where, you know, all it takes is hitting the wrong guy or hitting the house next door, or then you've got blood revenge going on all over the place. Or think of our own situation. Let's say that, you know, somebody from abroad really needed to kill somebody in Camden or something and fired a drone you know, maybe it didn't even hurt you or any of your relatives, but you're getting kind of pissed off at these Canadians for firing drones on Camden. You start, and even if the Canadians are serving our interests, you know, what the hell are they doing dropping bombs on our territory? And then if you keep doing this after a while, and even if it's done, by the way, in cahoots with the governor of Maine, just as a lot of the drones dropped in Pakistan and Yemen are done with full knowledge of the heads of... In fact, for a while, the drone base was in Pakistan, so they know what we're doing, but still the people get annoyed. And one thing you're trying to do is to adjust the politics of the country. It starts getting to be very counterproductive if you drive away the sentiments of the favor of the people. So it is something, it's a marvelous technology. It's a weapon that has its place in the context of a war going on. For example, in Iraq, you know, you could use these drones to watch out. You would see people laying roadside bombs. You could then see where he goes back. You know where the hideout is, and then you can bomb the hideout. That was in the context of a war. This was definitely a combatant. But, you know, killing some low-level guys doing training exercises on a hill in Pakistan or in Yemen, You know, there are a few exceptions where it's worth the risks that are entailed, but in the most case, it's war is, as Clausewitz said, politics by other means. And drone warfare is usually very bad politics.
We've got two questions here about how to know an insurgency when you see it, and that a counterinsurgency is called for. And in particular, is counterinsurgency something that always leads us into nation building?
Well, that's the way that David Petraeus would define counterinsurgency, yes. I kind of look at counterinsurgency with a small c. He has a definition of counterinsurgency which has, you know, eight articles and 25 sub-articles, and this is the way to do it. My view is, well, look, actually, let's look at it as countering an insurgency. And there are more or less appropriate ways to do that. And by the way, there are a lot of insurgencies that we have no business getting involved with at all. And in fact, there are some insurgencies that we support, you know, that are good guys, right? So, you know, it's also, that's another problem with counterinsurgency. It's ethically a little iffy. I mean, you know, you could make a case that, you know, inside Germany, the Nazis were engaged in counterinsurgency strategies, right? You know, against Jewish uprising, that sort of thing.
Well, since you put it that way, isn't Assad involved in counterinsurgency?
Absolutely.
In your August 24th article, you suggest that we're likely to bomb Assad's regime in Syria, but speak to whether he's been effective in his own counterinsurgency against the Syrian opposition.
Well, it's a very brutal, it wouldn't be the Petraeus kind of counterinsurgency, which is to provide base. If he were advised by David Petraeus, he would, you know, provide services to the Christians and try to reach out to, you know, both sectarian groups and you know, if they're upset at me. No, it's just bombing people. He that's a classic case of enlarging your opposition. Mm. He did it all wrong. Although, yeah. Listen, brute force sometimes works. Mm.
Could you talk a bit about the role of ethnography in generating counterinsurgency tactics? Was cultural understanding in, for instance, Iraq and Afghanistan, our attempt to involve cultural understanding limited to simply translation services?
No, there were, in fact, these things developed called, human terrain teams, I think they were called. And they were started by an anthropologist named, this is why there were copies. I wish there were some copies of my book here. Montgomery Mitzi McFate. And they set up these teams, and she was inspired by some things that Margaret Mead did in World War II and Gregory Bateson. And the idea was to get a very firm grip on the culture of certain groups inside Iraq, what their real needs were, what kinds of, you know, signs and values appealed to them, and to try to do a plan that appealed to those interests. Again, there were some isolated spots where it did have some effect, but even in times in history when people from foreign countries, from imperial powers going in, really do know a lot about the region. For example, all the Brits who were in the Middle East during World War I, they really did know quite a lot about the region, but they still messed it up. They drew lines in the sand and created national borders and installed kings who really had their own special interests. And we are living with a legacy of those decisions even today. In fact, I think what's really going on in the Middle East right now is the crumbling of that order that was put in place mainly by the British and French at the end of World War I.
We're supposed to end with a softball question. I'm not sure this is a softball, but you made Rumsfeld seem semi-incompetent by saying he had no phase 4 plan at all, just none, that he wouldn't allow the word insurgency to be used. And yet, as your talk developed, maybe he just foresaw what eventually happened, that all of these counterinsurgencies are to some extent doomed because they're happening in places that are natural candidates for the insurgents to win.
Well, let me parse this out a bit then. He wasn't incompetent. Rumsfeld was enamored of these new wonder weapons, the smart bombs. He subscribed to this theory of transformation, where you could fight wars just with smart bombs and very small units on the ground. And this was deliberate. He did two things. He wrested away control of post-war Iraq from the State Department because he didn't want there to be a post-war Iraq. In other words, not an American post-war Iraq. And the reason why he wanted us to get out right away wasn't so much because he foresaw all this. I don't think that's true. He wanted to go on to the next place. He wanted to be able to tell people, look, bad guy, you know, we can come in and just topple your government with one hand tied behind our back, and then we can go on to the next place. But if you get involved in a counterinsurgency campaign and you're there for 10 years, that sort of nullifies his whole point. So no, he had a very strategic outlook on this. It was a strategic outlook stemming from his view that we were now in a unipolar world, where the United States was the only superpower, and that it was time to push that and to get rid of, you know, he thought that a couple aircraft carriers headed toward North Korea would make Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un, now Kim Jong-un, at the time it was Kim Jong-il, shaking his boots. He thought that, you know, he was seriously talking about after Iraq comes the Syrians, and the North Koreans are raising problems. He thought that you could do all of this with force. But within that framework, this was forced to be, it was in and out. And I don't think that he foresaw what would happen in Iraq. I think really he didn't even think about it. It wasn't even on his mind. People I know who worked with him in the Pentagon and who really still like and admire him told me that you could tell. As soon as Saddam Hussein fell, he lost all interest in Iraq. You couldn't talk to him about it. He wasn't interested in any meetings. And that's when Wolfowitz sort of took over that department. So half yes, half no on that one.
The British had this concept of a punitive expedition. I think maybe Rumsfeld was thinking of Iraq purely as a punitive expedition.
I think he saw it more as a laboratory for these new weapons. Ah. He did think from the beginning that Iraq had to have had something to do with September 11th. It was one of these things. See, all the distorted intelligence about weapons of mass destruction and Iraq, I don't think that they were lying. I think they really did believe that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and there was some kind of link between Saddam and al-Qaeda. And what they cherry-picked things that highlighted that. I think it reminds me of the great columnist Murray Kempton, who walked out of a mafia trial one day and said to a colleague, "It's amazing, they're framing a guilty man in there." So I think he thought that this was obviously that Saddam had nukes, and it was obvious, and so we have to frame it. The problem was it turned out that the guilty man, at least on those charges, wasn't guilty.
Thank you, Fred.
Thank you.
Hold on a second.